Good morning. On today's programme, Kenya's devastating El Niño deluge and Canary Islands authorities seek to attract tourists who will spend more money. But first we go to Canada and a warning that some listeners may find the contents of this next report distressing. An Ontario man is facing 14 charges of first-degree murder after he is alleged to have sent lethal substances to help victims to take their own lives. Although the charges are only in Ontario, 58-year-old Kenneth Law is alleged to have sent similar packages to more than 40 countries. He also faces charges of counselling and aiding suicide. Kenneth Law's lawyer says his client will plead not guilty. Dan Karpinchuk reports.
Kenneth Law is a former chef who worked at a luxury downtown hotel in Toronto. He's been in the custody of Canadian authorities since being arrested in May of last year. The Canadian police investigation began after the sudden death of an adult in the Toronto area. Police say the victim is believed to have died after ingesting a lethal substance purchased from Law. Then there was a second death allegedly linked to Law. Canadian authorities now believe that through his websites, Law, since 2020, sent as many as 1,200 packages to people in more than 40 countries. Several countries, including Britain, New Zealand, and Italy, have launched investigations into deaths in their countries, possibly linked to Law's websites. The investigations are now part of an ongoing multi-country probe into the widespread sale of chemicals online. A 23-year-old woman from Dundee, Scotland, says she nearly died after ingesting a toxic substance sold to her online. Emma Morrison says she was facing a mental health crisis when she met the so-called Greenberg on a pro-suicide forum. She says she was then guided to a separate website run by Law. She believes that Greenberg was Law himself. She was sent a link to a now inoperative site called Imtime Cuisine. There were also instructions on how to take the products. Ontario police have linked that website to Law. 11 police forces in Ontario are now involved in a probe of Law's activities. And even more questions have now been raised about Law, who has been called the poison killer, and his connection to the mysterious Greenberg. Police allege that Law operated a series of websites selling dangerous items to buyers. So far, Law's products are suspected of being tied to more than 120 deaths worldwide, and that includes many in the United Kingdom. The National Crime Agency in Britain has linked at least 88 deaths to Kenneth Law. In a statement, the agency said 232 individuals have been identified as having purchased products from Canadian websites to assist with suicide. Law's current legal case does not include cases outside Canadian jurisdiction. The NCAA's statement also says in consultation with the Crown Prosecution Service, it has decided to conduct an investigation into potential criminal offences committed in the UK. That operation is underway. Law's arrest has also sent shockwaves through the internet, and many people will be watching his trial, hoping for justice. People like Kelly Wilson of the US and Catherine Adenikin of Britain, both of them mothers who lost children who accessed pro-suicide forums. Wilson says these sites sell to vulnerable people, aiding and abetting suicide. That, she says, is akin to murder. She adds that Law weaponized mentally ill people against themselves and that should not be allowed to continue. But she maintains that the root cause of the problem is the pro-suicide forums. Law has said he's not responsible for what people do with his products and has denied the charges. His lawyer says his client will plead not guilty. None of the charges against him have been proven in court, and no charges have been presented for cases outside of Canada.
That was Dan Karpinchuk reporting from Canada. And for any listeners affected by that report, help is available on rte.ie/helplines. Next, we go to Kenya. The weather phenomenon known as El Niño has caused severe rainfall, which has been battering Kenya for several months now. Over 100 El Niño-related deaths have been recorded, while tropical storms have washed away roads, homes, and damaged cropland. From Nairobi, Amy Nirida reports.
There was talk of El Niño in Kenya long before it arrived last October. Those who remembered the events of 1997 when El Niño last struck with full effect hoped that predictions would be wrong and resemble the scenes of 2010 when it was last predicted. those rains were considered moderate or mild in comparison to those of the 1997 event, which saw 10 months of tropical rainstorms, an extreme weather event that the government was in no way prepared for, and a devastating chapter in a very young republic's history books. This current instalment of El Niño is all too familiar. Widespread landslides and flooding have devastated thousands of landowners, while crater-sized potholes are causing major traffic jams in Nairobi. Crops have been destroyed, the ground on which they were planted completely washed away, as are many, many homes in informal settlements across the country. But what exactly is this phenomenon? Scientifically, an El Niño event is typically declared when sea surface temperatures in the tropical eastern Pacific rise to at least half a degree Celsius above the long-term average. Last July, the World Meteorological Organization announced that El Niño conditions had begun to develop. The hottest year on record, 2023, was boosted by El Niño conditions. It could mean that 2024 is even hotter. For the past 2 weeks, the country's capital has been going through a dry spell, but we're not out of the woods yet. If the rains return, as they're predicted to, at this rate they'll fall on incredibly dry soil. That hard rain overwhelms its absorbing properties. Instead of soaking it in, dry, cracked soil will simply repel the water, resulting in flash flooding and the erosion of any fertile land. Maura Maneni has begun planting again. Having spent 15,000 Kenyan shillings, approximately €90, a hefty sum for a small farmer, on repairing her land in December. She tells me she'll put her faith in God that the rains will come, but that they won't come with the force they've been known to over the past 4 months. I also visited Anne, a mother of four children living in Olopolo slum just outside Nairobi. Her house, which consists of a shack constructed out of stone, mud and corrugated iron, is dark and damp. The electricity in the house hasn't worked since the rain started 4 months ago. The remnants of the last shower are dripping through a rusted gap where the corrugated iron has been corroded. She has a bunk bed, a couch and a table in her house. Sitting on the edge of the bed, I can feel a dampness seeping through my shorts and up my back. There's a four-year-old child sleeping in the same bed. Anne shows me her son's school books, which have been destroyed by the floods. She had taken them out on loan, unable to pay for them outright, but now the school is looking for the cost of the damaged books in order to replace them. The rains, when they arrive, come thick and fast without warning. There's only a matter of seconds between normal overcast and often sunny weather and an almighty drenching. While climate change means the seasons are harder to predict in the southern hemisphere, December is generally a sure bet for dry, warm weather in Kenya. Come February, any signs of the rainy season between July and November have disappeared. The greenery should be brown or yellow, fields burnt, and red soil roads should be dusty enough to put you off walking anywhere. This year, though, foliage in Nairobi is in full bloom at this late stage of the dry season. Thousands of butterflies and other pollinators can be seen in any one field, hard at work, making the most of the luscious greenery around them. Of course, for the animals, the rains have been a blessing. The long green grasses and overflowing watering holes means that game reserves such as the Masai Mara are thriving. It's also a treat for tourists who on arrival at Jomo Kenyatta International Airport are met with much more colourful, vibrant surroundings than those often portrayed on nature documentaries. For residents here though, the green grass is a reminder of the potential El Niño has, and the uncertainty around its return has generated a huge sense of unease. NGOs are under pressure trying to support displaced families and offset the loss of livestock in areas with no drainage infrastructure. Only time will tell if the progress they're making will be in vain. For World Report, this is Amini Riada in Nairobi.
Finally, we go to the Canary Islands, where local administrators have become more vocal about the need to attract not more tourists, but tourists who spend more money. In Lanzarote, the president of the island government said last year that tourism had reached its limit, and as part of a sustainability drive, administrators increasingly want the kind of visitor who is prepared to splash the cash. From Tenerife, Cliona O'Flynn reports.
There are more similarities between Tenerife and Ireland than you may think. Tenerife is, or certainly was, an agricultural-based economy prior to the last quarter of the 20th century, with no industrial base to speak of, as were the other Canary Islands. There are other interesting links that might pique an historian's interest. The Irish wild geese were not unknown here in the 17th and 18th centuries. The Irish Fives Company was a major employer in Adeje, where I now live, in the early 20th century. But more obvious is the role of tourism as a vital economic cog. I'm not proposing to detail here the rise of tourism in Tenerife, how the Scandinavians' interest in the winter warm weather as a health restorative was an important key in the early development of the south of the island. But like parts of Ireland, tourism was and is the key to social and economic changes that people have seen in less than 50 years. While the island might not have experienced the same concrete booms as other resort areas of Spain, the rise of sun and sea visitors from other parts of the world, particularly Northern Europe, gave rise to enormous changes, and today tourism is the economic motor that drives the main islands. But the islands are small. Geographically, they are limited by their size, and with a very public recognition by local administrations that there needs to be moves towards what is now termed sustainable tourism. The kind of tourist that the islands are seeking is changing. Not more visitors, but visitors that spend more money during their stay. In simple terms, that is the new profile local tourism bodies are seeking. Just under a year ago, the president of the Lanzarote Island government, Maria Dolores Corujo, sparked irate headlines and reams of column inches in British newspapers when she stated that the island's tourism capacity had reached its limit, and added to this praise for the German tourist as a higher quality kind of visitor. To put this in context, her remarks were made in advance of the Berlin Tourism Fair. The president stated that the island's tourist capacity had reached its limit and it had to prioritise a rational and lasting development based on quality, adding that the island had to reduce its reliance on British tourists. Around half of all the tourists who visit the island are British, and one tabloid quoted an Irish-born local bar owner as saying, "The English and the Irish bring us our bread and butter. They're the ones ordering beers since 9 o'clock in the morning." President Corujo quickly walked back or clarified her remarks, saying for the record that British tourists were always welcome. But the basis of her original statement, the point she was making, was that she wants to change the island's approach to tourism. She said the stance would mean aspiring to receive fewer visitors with greater spending in the destination and move towards diversification to reduce the dependence on the British market. And in the wider frame in any business model, reducing dependence on a single source market makes sense. It makes sense for the other Canary Islands too. And a year later, those sentiments are being repeated elsewhere, but not attracting the same kind of clickbait headlines as before. Just a week ago, in advance of Fitur, the Spanish tourism trade fair taking place in Madrid, I spoke to the Adeje Councillor for Tourism, Patricia Paulson. She didn't name any particular nationality. No one's falling into that trap here. And here too, British tourists are hugely important. But she openly stated that Costa Adeje is no longer just a beer, beach and sun destination, though it will always have that offer. She said the numbers for 2024 looked good, but they were not going to visit tourism trade fairs to increase tourism numbers, but to explain and offer a move to a more qualitative tourism. "This is our aim now," she said. "We keep the numbers, but make a bit more money." The statement is reflective of what the local mayor has said over recent years, that tourism is supposed to bring money into all aspects of the destination. So we are seeing less and less all-inclusive, only 4- and 5-star hotels being built, with an emphasis on the growing number of Michelin-star restaurants in the islands too. There is also, in parallel, a growth in professional training in the sector, from bar staff to management, with the acknowledgement that if you want people to spend more money, you know they will expect better services. The notion that the islands are full is now an accepted one. So managing the numbers and increasing the earnings while maintaining some kind of sustainability is the new challenge. It means new destination offers, such as increased rural tourism, sport-based stays. And certainly there are many Irish who still like to spend much of the winter months here, although Brexit has robbed many British of that luxury. In terms of spend per tourist, Maria Dolores Corujo knew what she was talking about, and German tourists are consistently the highest spenders when on holiday among travellers from within the EU. The European Union Europa figures show too that Irish visitors, along with a few other countries, ring up a healthy spend of €120 per person per night. There are still some cheap holidays available, but the era of the bargain basement all-inclusive package holiday to most of the Canary Islands is very much on the wane. And the new direction is seen as the right way forward for most of us residents, and certainly for those who work in the sector directly or indirectly. In the past, the all-inclusive holiday did nothing for the surrounding villages, but these days the change is noticeable, though it has also led to a cost of living increase that means many workers are finding it harder to live in the more popular resort areas where they work. But perhaps that's a story for another day. For World Report, this is Cliona O'Flynn in Tenerife.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.